Hello, book lovers everywhere. I'm Elaine Charles, and it's a pleasure to welcome you, my radio readers, back to the Book Report. Every week at this time, we look at what and who are hot in the world of books. Last week, we had the fun of previewing the fabulous Miami International Book Fair. The fair has been going on all week, and I can tell you, I've been running from one famous author to another, asking them what they're reading and to hear the inside story on their books. The fair ends on Sunday, and it's been hectic and terrific to talk to people like Pat Conroy, Brad Meltzer, and a slew of others. I'll be bringing you my personal chats with many of these authors over the next few weeks, so be sure to tune back in. But now, it's time to kick back and curl up with family and friends as we prepare for Thanksgiving. And when you need some relaxation at this busy time, you can always curl up with a good book. So this week, let's get our minds and our stomachs ready for one of the most beloved American holidays. We'll revel in a little sentimental Americana, highlight a few books you can read after Thanksgiving dinner, or even give as gifts to remind those who need reminding how much they have to be thankful for. And of course, no Thanksgiving would be complete without a good cookbook. So join me after the break as we get deep into our Thanksgiving special.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MAGICBUZ.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
If you're a foodie, and who isn't at Thanksgiving time, it doesn't matter where in the country you live. I bet you are familiar with the Food Network's South Beach Wine and Food Festival. To quote the one and only Anthony Bourdain, it was Lee Brian Schrager who turned a small festival in 2002 into, quote, the combination Woodstock, Sundance, Cannes, and Altamont of the food world, the world's premier gathering of chefs. Lee Brian Schrager graduated from the Culinary Institute of America, but he never actually wanted to be a chef. He ended up in Miami, opened nightclubs, dabbled in gourmet retail, did event planning, and he even owned a dinner club with actor Mickey Rourke. In 2000, he was hired by Southern Wine and Spirits to be their director of media and special events. One of his tasks was to upgrade a one-day wine tasting event, the Florida Extravaganza, which benefited Florida International University School of Hospitality and Tourism Management. And the rest, as we say, is some very delicious history. This year's South Beach Wine and Food Festival, to be held February 24th to 27th, expects a crowd of more than 50,000. Lee also began the wildly successful Food Network New York City Wine and Food Festival, which takes place throughout the Big Apple. Now, to celebrate the South Beach Festival's 10th year, Lee has just released the Food Network's South Beach Wine and Food Festival cookbook. It features recipes, everything from drinks to desserts, from fan favorites like Rachel Ray, Guy Fieri, Bobby Flay, Emeril, and so many more. Listeners, it's a wonderfully fun read, with great behind-the-scenes stories from top chefs, and the recipes are divine. Welcome, Lee, and thanks for being with us today.
It's great to be here.
I want to just jump right into the festival as it's heading towards its 10th year. Can you share some of the highlights, those golden moments, with our listeners?
Well, I mean, every year there's something unique about it. I mean, when I think back to my favorite memories over the 10 years, clearly year one when we didn't know what we were doing, and I don't know that we ever knew what we were doing, but clearly year one we certainly didn't know what we were doing. And of course, the year number five when we got that big thunderstorm that kind of rained out our barbecue, and that's in the book. Actually, it's called The Great Storm. It's one of the centerpiece stories of the book when we really got just totally rained out of our signature event, and Bobby Flay was hosting it that year. Of course, things that come to mind for me that are very special is honoring Ferran Adria a few years ago, one of the greatest chefs in the world, when we had the most extraordinary roster of talent cooking that dinner. Thomas Keller and Jean Georges and Pierre Hermé and José Andrés. It was really quite an evening. I loved when we honored Jamie Oliver, who's one of my favorite personalities, and Alice Waters presented him with a special award that we created really just for Jamie Oliver. And of course, 3 years ago, when we honored the Mondavi brothers, Peter and Robert Mondavi, who had really been estranged from one another for many years, and this was the first time they actually sat at a table together, and it was very emotional. And you kind of knew that there wouldn't be many more times like that because Robert was already very frail, and sadly he did pass away a few months after that. And of course, the King and Queen of Spain coming a few years ago, and the Mario Batali rant that went on around that, and Gordon Ramsay coming and going a few years ago, with us never knowing exactly what went wrong with him. So, lots of fun memories, lots of fun stories, and I don't have a particular one, but kind of that sums them all up.
What new events will be at this year's festival?
Well, for the 2011 Food Network South Beach Wine and Food Festival to commemorate 10 years of us, we are doing a party at this amazing parking garage in the corner of Lincoln Road in Alton.
I know
It's really extraordinary. And
it.
from the moment I saw it being built, I thought that they were building a banquet space, but it's a parking garage. And I said from the get-go that we would do a party there when I first saw it like 3 years ago. And we are doing our official 10-year anniversary party and also the kind of my book launch here for South Florida. Although it's coming out in November, it's really this will be the big Florida party around the book. I'm kind of holding off until the festival. And we are doing a party at 1111 called Let Them Eat Cake. And Martha Stewart and Emeril Lagasse are hosting that event. And it's about a dozen of your favorite cake bakers from out the country, all who you always see in all those cake reality shows, all preparing a special cake featured, focused around our 10-year anniversary. And at midnight, we're going to have my favorite burger of all time, Shake Shack, doing burger shakes and fries. So that and Martha and Emeril make for a very special 10-year anniversary.
Talking of the cookbook, I've seen it. It's beautiful. It's colorful. It's a great mix of recipes and memories. How did you and your team actually decide which recipes were going to be included and which personalities?
Well, it's two different questions. I mean, it was a very long process, and collecting the recipes turned out to be one of the easier parts, and it was not easy, but we collected almost 500 recipes going back many years. We went back to every personality who's participated and asked them for a recipe that they did while they were here in South Beach, and many did not even remember what they had done 8 years ago. But we managed to get almost 500 recipes, and then we br had to break them down into chapters. Which were not clearly defined at that point. So, from the 500 recipes, we ended up with seven chapters: a dessert chapter, a drink chapter, a small plate chapter, a big plate chapter, a burger chapter, a barbecue chapter, and there's a seventh chapter I probably can't remember, maybe appetizers. So once we collected the recipes, we broke them down into chapters. Then we had to look at which ones were accessible for the home cook. Then we had to see which one were ingredients based upon the home cook. Then we had to test every one of them. So it was a long process, probably a 4 month process or 5 month process of breaking down the recipes once we received them. And then once they were tested, we had to retest them again, per the cookbook publisher's policy. So it was a very intense, and it was very emotional, cutting out people. Every time we had to cut something, whether it was too many words or not focused on a home cook, it was like, oh my God, we can't get rid of that one. He's a favorite. And they were all favorites, so it was very difficult.
I have to say that in looking at the recipes, many of them look like even me, a cooking nitwit, could do them and do them well. So kudos to you and your staff for those selections.
Thank you.
Well, this is our Thanksgiving show, so I just have to ask, what are your favorite dishes for the big day?
Reservations. I actually, up until about 3 years ago, it was the one meal that I did cook every year and had probably 80 to 100 people over. I probably did Thanksgiving for 20 years at my homes. And a few years ago, my mom and dad said, oh, we're going to go on a cruise. I hope we don't mind. And I took that opportunity not to do Thanksgiving, and I never picked it back up, I am happy to say. And I think it's 3 or 4 years. And although I kind of miss having everyone over and all the amazing food, many of my friends are great cooks, I don't miss all the work that goes into it. And I miss doing it, just not the work, and I just don't have that time. So last year, we were actually in Peru. The year before that, we went to a friend's house. And then the year before that, my parents had gone out of town, so we went to Buenos Aires with friends. This year, all of my parents are here, and thank God my family's all here. And we're trying to find something that's open on Thanksgiving Day.
Chinese,
where all Jewish families end up, exactly.
Right.
We may just end up at Tropical Chinese or Hakkasan.
Uh-huh. Well, speaking of that, when you go out on a normal weekend with friends, what are some of your favorite dishes that you order in restaurants?
Well, we eat out 7 nights a week, so it's, you know, I always ask people to narrow it down when they ask my favorite restaurant, meaning local restaurant, Italian restaurant, Chinese restaurant, steak restaurants, because we eat everything. I'd have to say, and I often tweet about it because I'm a big tweeter and Facebook follower, clearly chicken is one of my favorite dishes. I love red meat, but tend not to order it as often as I'd like to for obvious reasons. I think if you ask my three favorite dishes, it is Michelle Bernstein's fried chicken that she does in the summer. It's Michael Schwartz Poulet Rouge from Michael's Genuine that I always order. And then it's the chef from Sugarcane has a whole roast chicken. So we have a roast chicken, a fried chicken, and a roasted chicken. And so I clearly those are my three favorite chicken dishes.
Well, about the restaurant business today, how has it changed since you started out? And would you encourage a kid thinking of a career to jump right in, or...?
I think the culinary world is, you know, more popular than ever. I mean, when I go up to the Culinary Institute of America, where I graduated from in 1979, and I look at the kids today, they're really young. Or maybe they just look young because I'm really old. But, you know, it's fascinating. When I went to the CIA, people were going back to the school for second careers. I went to the Culinary Institute right out of college. But, you know, my class had 30 people in it, or 20-something people in it. And I bet you more than half of them was a second career, whether it was lawyers, doctors, accountants, whatever it was, people who really wanted to go back and focus on their, you know, their dreams of a culinary career. Today, the Culinary Institute is something that you learn from junior high school. Teachers are talking about it. And, you know, you have role models like Bobby Flay and Emeril, and everyone wants to be a chef today, where when I was growing up, you wanted to be a president or an accountant or a doctor. Now you talk to kids, I go in junior achievement classes, and people want to be cooks. And, you know, people like Bobby and Emeril and Guy Fieri and Rachel and Jada and, you know, really made it okay for kids, little boys and girls, who want to have a career in the culinary arts world. So whether you're going to the culinary school to get a degree or just to have that knowledge, which is kind of what I did so I could use it in my later years, I think that I would strongly encourage everyone. I think it's probably one of the greatest, you know, decisions that I ever made, or that my parents helped me make, was to go and pursue a career in the culinary arts.
Oh, that's great. Thanks so much, Lee. Listeners, February is a great time to head down to Miami Beach. Check out the festival online at www.sobewineandfoodfest.com. You will love it. Speaking of Thanksgiving, let's go back in time and rediscover the classic stories of an American short story icon, O. Henry. In Two Gentlemen at Thanksgiving, we hear the tale of what happens to two New York guys after an embarrassingly large feast. Let's listen to this story of O. Henry's Thanksgiving in New York, read by B.J. Harrison.
Stuffy Pete's appearance at the annual trysting place seemed to have been rather the result of habit than of the yearly hunger, which, as the philanthropists seem to think, afflicts the poor at such extended intervals. Certainly Pete was not hungry. He had just come from a feast that had left him of his powers barely those of respiration and locomotion. His eyes were like two pale gooseberries firmly embedded in a swollen and gravy-smeared mask of putty. His breath came in short wheezes. A senatorial roll of adipose tissue denied a fashionable set to his upturned coat collar. Buttons that had been sewed upon his clothes by kind Salvation fingers a week before flew like popcorn, strewing the earth around him. Ragged he was, with a split shirt front open to the waistbone, but the November breeze, carrying fine snowflakes, brought him only a grateful coolness. For Stuffy Pete was overcharged with a caloric produced by a super bountiful dinner, beginning with oysters and ending with plum pudding and including, it seemed to him, all the roast turkey and baked potatoes and chicken salad and squash pie and ice cream in the world. Wherefore he sat, gorged, and gazed upon the world with after-dinner contempt. The meal had been an unexpected one. He was passing a red brick mansion near the beginning of Fifth Avenue, in which lived two old ladies of ancient family and a reverence for traditions. They even denied the existence of New York and believed that Thanksgiving Day was declared solely for Washington Square. One of their traditional habits was to station a servant at the postern gate with orders to admit the first hungry wayfarer that came along after the hour of noon had struck, and banquet him to a finish. Stuffy Pete happened to pass by on his way to the park, and the seneschals gathered him in and upheld the custom of the castle. After Stuffy Pete had gazed straight before him for 10 minutes, he was conscious of a desire for a more varied field of vision. With a tremendous effort, he moved his head slowly to the left, and then his eyes bulged out fearfully, and his breath ceased, and the roughshod ends of his short legs wriggled and rustled on the gravel. For the old gentleman was coming across Fourth Avenue toward his bench. Every Thanksgiving Day for 9 years, the old gentleman had come there and found Stuffy Pete on his bench. That was a thing that the old gentleman was trying to make a tradition of. Every Thanksgiving Day for 9 years, he had found Stuffy there and had led him to a restaurant and watched him eat a big dinner. They do those things in England unconsciously, but this is a young country, and 9 years is not so bad. The old gentleman was a staunch American patriot and considered himself a pioneer in American tradition. In order to become picturesque, we must keep on doing one thing for a long time without ever letting it get away from us. Something like collecting the weekly dimes in industrial insurance or cleaning the streets. The old gentleman moved, straight and stately, toward the institution that he was rearing. Truly, the annual feeding of Stuffy Pete was nothing national in its character, such as the Magna Carta or jam for breakfast was in England. But it was a step. It was almost feudal. It showed at least that a custom was not impossible to New York... America. The old gentleman was thin and tall and 60. He was dressed all in black and wore the old-fashioned kind of glasses that won't stay on your nose. His hair was whiter and thinner than it had been last year, and he seemed to make more use of his big, knobby cane with a crooked handle. As his established benefactor came up, Stuffy wheezed and shuddered like some woman's overfat pug when a street dog bristles up at him.
Some people love him, and some people love to hate him. The question is, dear readers, are you going to love the book? Broke, The Plan to Restore Our Trust, Truth, and Treasure by Glenn Beck with Kevin Balfe, sees our country as an empire on the edge of chaos. Why? Well, according to Mr. Beck, the answer is simple. We've turned our backs on the Constitution. Yes, he says our country is financially broke, but that's just a side effect of our broken spirit, our broken faith in government, broken promises by our leaders, and a broken political system that has centralized power at the expense of individualized rights. Beck says there is a lot of work ahead, but we can't move forward until we understand how we got here. Starting with the American Revolution, Glenn takes readers on an express train through 234 years of history,
culminating with the Great Recession and the bipartisan recklessness of Presidents Bush and Obama. Along the way, Beck explains how everything you thought you knew about political parties is a lie, how Democrats and Republicans used to fight for minimum government and maximum freedom, but now how both parties have been taken over by a cancer called progressivism. Is this the history lesson you wish you had in high school? You decide. Broke, read by Glenn Beck and Brian Sack.
This audiobook is about learning from the past and seeing that minimum government, maximum freedom isn't just a catchy slogan. It was once a way of life in America, and it is a way of life that we can have back. My hope is this will help you think out of the box politically and motivate you to challenge those who are blocking the doorway to restoration. The time for trusting others in government based on a D or an R has long since passed. Trust yourself. Trust your neighbors. Live your life the right way and prepare to witness miracles. God is not done with freedom. And quite frankly, neither am I. But it all starts with you. You have to find your role, your place in this fight. Remember, the heroes we read about in history books, Paul Revere, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, were usually only a very small part of the story. You don't have to ride the horse at midnight yourself to make a real difference. You just have to help make sure that someone else can. In a few minutes, Brian Sack, who you may know from one of his many appearances on my radio show over the years, is going to take over some of the reading. Now, Brian is a friend, and I did just use air quotes, and I guess you could consider him a writer, air quotes again, though it seems like someone would actually have to buy what you write in order for you to be considered a professional, but maybe that's just me. Anyway, I'll be setting up some of the topics that we cover in Broke, and then Brian will handle the rest. Just remember, I only hired him to read my audiobook, not to ad-lib it or sprinkle in his simple little thoughts. Just read it, word for word. Got it, Brian? Part 1. The past is prologue. Quote, "We are perhaps too much inclined to think that external invasion is the only way a civilization can die. If the lights that guide us ever go out, they will fade little by little, as if of their own accord. We therefore should not console ourselves by thinking that the barbarians are still a long way off. Some peoples may let the torch be snatched from their hands, but others will stamp it out themselves." Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America. Chapter 1. Ancient History, Modern Lessons. If history teaches us one thing, it is this: empires tend to crumble from the inside. If history teaches us two things, it is that very few people ever see it coming. Perhaps it is because of those two great lessons that George Santayana's famous line continually rings true across civilizations and across the ages. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Time and time again, once great countries have failed because their citizens thought it would never happen to them. They thought they were immune. They thought they were different. They thought they were better. They were wrong. That is the real danger facing America today. The 2.4 million men and women in our armed forces can and will defeat any foreign enemy we ever face. But it is no longer foreign threats that pose the greatest danger to our future. Indeed, as Tocqueville presciently warned, we are our own greatest danger. We're on the verge of stamping out ourselves. In other words, we have met the enemy, and he is us. The real battle we're fighting right now is with the laws of economics, and it's a war that cannot be won. It's like attempting to fight gravity by constantly jumping. There are slivers in time when it might feel like you're winning, that you've actually changed the laws of nature. Then you crash back to Earth, and eventually, you just get too tired to jump anymore. Gravity wins. It always does. Likewise, the laws of economics say that when expenses are higher than revenues, for a prolonged period of time, there will be repercussions.
In the just-released memoir, Decision Points, President George W. Bush describes the critical decisions of his presidency and his personal life. But unlike other political autobiographies, Bush offers a candid journey through the defining decisions of his life. He brings listeners inside the Texas governor's mansion on the night of the hotly contested 2000 election, aboard Air Force One on 9/11, at the head of the table in the Situation Room in the moments before launching the war in Iraq, and behind the Oval Office desk for his historic and controversial decisions on the financial crisis, Hurricane Katrina, and the other issues that have shaped the first decade of the 21st century. President Bush writes honestly and directly about his flaws and mistakes, as well as his accomplishments. He also offers intimate new details on his decisions to quit drinking, his discovery of faith, and his relationship with his family. Whether you like or hate George W., Decision Points, read by Ron McLarty, is a new kind of memoir. Let's listen.
In the final years of my presidency, I began to think seriously about writing my memoirs. On the recommendation of Karl Rove, I met with more than a dozen distinguished historians. To a person, they told me I had an obligation to write. They felt it was important that I record my perspective on the presidency in my own words. Have you ever seen the movie Apollo 13? The historian Jay Wenick asked. Everyone knows the astronauts make it home in the end, but you're on the edge of your seat wondering how they do it. Nearly all the historians suggested that I read Memoirs by President Ulysses S. Grant, which I did. The book captures his distinctive voice. He uses anecdotes to recreate his experience during the Civil War. I could see why his work had endured. Like Grant, I decided not to write an exhaustive account of my life or presidency. Instead, I have told the story of my time in the White House by focusing on the most important part of the job, making decisions. Each chapter is based on a major decision or a series of related decisions. As a result, the book flows thematically, not in a day-by-day chronology. I do not cover all of the important issues that crossed my desk. Many devoted members of my cabinet and staff are mentioned briefly or not at all. I value their service, and I will always be grateful for their contributions. My goals in writing this book are twofold. First, I hope to paint a picture of what it was like to serve as president for 8 consequential years. I believe it will be impossible to reach definitive conclusions about my presidency, or any recent presidency for that matter, for several decades. The passage of time allows passions to cool, results to clarify, and scholars to compare different approaches. My hope is that this book will serve as a resource for anyone studying this period in American history. Second, I write to give readers a perspective on decision-making in a complex environment. Most of the decisions that reach the president's desk are tough calls with strong arguments on both sides. Throughout the book, I describe the options I weighed and the principles I followed. I hope this will give you a better sense of why I made the decisions I did. Perhaps it will even prove useful as you make choices in your own life. Decision Points is based primarily on my recollections. With help from researchers, I have confirmed my account with government documents, contemporaneous notes, personal interviews, news reports, and other sources, some of which remain classified. There were instances in which I had to rely on my memory alone. If there are inaccuracies in this book, the responsibility is mine. I've done my best to write about the decisions I got right, those I got wrong, and what I would do differently if given the chance. Of course, in the presidency, there are no do-overs. You have to do what you believe is right and accept the consequences. I tried to do that every day of my 8 years in office. Serving as your president was the honor of a lifetime. and I appreciate your giving me an opportunity to share my story.
Social media, it's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Thanksgiving is all about families. Readers, that's why I thought you might enjoy a look at one of America's first families, John and Abigail Adams. I first caught on to their incredible love story in the movie 1776. Didn't you just love that film? From then on, I read everything I could on this amazing couple. Now, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Joseph Ellis brings America's preeminent first couple to life in a moving and illuminating narrative that sweeps through the American Revolution and on through the Republic's tenuous early years. John and Abigail Adams left an indelible and remarkably preserved portrait of their lives together in their personal correspondence. Over the years, they exchanged more than 1,200 letters. Now, I know your kids send 1,200 text messages a day, but back then, 1,200 letters was quite something. I mean, think of the quill consumption. Joseph Ellis gives us an account both intimate and panoramic, part biography, part political history, and part love story. After they married, the couple was separated nearly as much as they were together. John's political career took him first to Philadelphia, where he toiled on the Declaration of Independence. Later, he was sent to Paris, serving as a minister to the court of France alongside Ben Franklin. John was then elected the nation's first vice president, but by this time, Abigail's health prevented her from joining him. But Abigail was by John's side as he became president. In Ellis's rich and striking new history, John and Abigail's relationship unfolds in the context of America's birth as a nation. Let's listen as Kimberly Farr narrates.
Abigail and John have much to teach us about both the reasons for that improbable success called the American Revolution and the equally startling capacity for a man and woman, husband and wife, to sustain their love over a lifetime filled with daunting challenges. One of the reasons for writing this book was to figure out how they did it. Knowing, as we do, that John and Abigail Adams were destined to become the most famous and consequential couple in the Revolutionary era, indeed, some would say the premier husband and wife team in all American history, it is somewhat disconcerting to realize that when they first met in the summer of 1759, neither one was particularly impressed by the other. The encounter occurred in the parlor of the pastor's house in Weymouth, Massachusetts, which happened to be the home of Abigail and her two sisters. Their father was the Reverend William Smith, whom John described in his diary as a crafty, designing man. A veteran public speaker, attuned to reading the eyes of his audience. "I caught him several times," wrote John, "looking earnestly at my face." Like most successful pastors, he was accustomed to being the center of attention, which apparently annoyed John, who described Reverend Smith prancing across the room while gesturing ostentatiously, clapping his naked sides and breasts with his hands before the girls. Abigail, in fact, was still a girl, not quite 15 years old, to John's 24. She was diminutive, barely 5 feet tall, with dark brown hair, brown eyes, and a slender shape, more attractive in our own time than then, when women were preferred to be plump. John was quite plump, or as men would have it, stout, already showing the signs that would one day allow his enemies to describe him as his rotundity. At 5 feet 5 or 6, he was slightly shorter than the average American male of the day, and his already receding hairline promised premature baldness. Neither one of them, at first glance, had the obvious glow of greatness. John's verdict, recorded in his diary, was that he had wasted an evening. He was courting Hannah Quincy at the time. Some say that she was actually courting him. And his first reaction was that neither Abigail nor her sisters could measure up to Hannah. They seemed to lack the conversational skills and just sat there. Not fond, nor frank, not candid. Since Abigail eventually proved to be all these things, we can only conclude that this first meeting was an awkward occasion on which the abiding qualities of her mind and heart were obscured beneath the frozen etiquette of a pastor's parlor. And besides, she was only a teenager, 9 years his junior, not even a legitimate candidate for his roving interest in a prospective wife. To say that something happened to change their respective opinions of each other over the next 3 years is obviously inadequate. But the absence of documentary evidence makes it the best we can do. John had legal business in Weymouth that involved the status of the pastoral house occupied by the Smith family, which meant that he was literally forced to interact with Abigail. And he accompanied his then-best friend Richard Cranch, who was courting and eventually married Mary Smith, Abigail's older sister. This, too, prompted interactions. And his flirtatious relationship with Hannah Quincy ended in a mutually declared romantic truce, which made John, once again, eligible. Time was also a factor. The difference between a 15-year-old girl and a 24-year-old man seemed a chasm. The difference between 18 and 27 was much more negotiable.
It's been 15 years, and the four women you loved from Waiting to Exhale are back, with a few more wrinkles, a few more pounds, and some of the same man issues. Yes, sister, yes. In Getting to Happy by Terry McMillan, we revisit the sassy and vibrant story of four African-American women struggling to find love and their place in the world. Savannah has awakened to the fact that she's made too many concessions in her marriage. Bernadine has watched her mega-divorce settlement dwindle, and she's been swindled by husband number two. Robin has an all-American case of shopaholism. Hey, I can relate. And for years, Gloria has taken happiness and security for granted. But being at the wrong place at the wrong time can change everything. All four are learning to heal past hurts and to reclaim their joy and their dreams. They return in this novel full of spirit and faith in one another. They've exhaled. Now they are learning to breathe. The book is read by an ensemble cast, including the author. Getting to Happy. Let's get to it.
If I could, you know I would, I say while checking my email. Of course, there are back-to-back messages from Robin, a joke I don't bother to read, and an attachment about a new motionless exercise she told me and Glory about last week that almost had us choking from laughter. She believes almost everything she sees on TV. You just don't want to go, he says, and starts looking through his pockets to make sure he has everything. He doesn't. I know just about all his patterns. Why don't you just come on out and say it? Because it wouldn't be true. I rarely lie, although I'm not always 100% honest. This is one of those times. Then I guess I'll see you on Tuesday, after rush hour. He walks over, presses his palms against my shoulder blades, gives them a little squeeze, bends over, and gives me a peck on the cheek. I don't feel a thing except the scratchy new growth on his face. "You have everything?" I ask. "What if I don't? Would it matter to you?" "Of course it would matter to me, Isaac." Right before he gets to the door leading to the garage, he turns and looks at me as if he doesn't believe me. Isaac knows we're on shaky ground. "I'm seriously beginning to think you might be racist." He's trying to find a button to push. I'm not falling for it. Part of our problem is he's forgotten how to talk to me. He's forgotten how to ask me a question that doesn't put me on the defensive. All those sessions with the marriage counselor, for some of which he played sick or was too busy drilling or hammering, aren't saving us. I'm tired of this war, which is why I'm ready to hold up a white flag. "Aren't you supposed to be picking up somebody? So now you're trying to get rid of me, is that it?" "Yes, how's that for an honest answer?" I feel my body stiffen, using the truth to lie. "Have a good time, Isaac. Wait a second. Did you remember to make the loan payment?" I only ask because he seems to have had a little bout of amnesia off and on in the past 6 or 7 months. It's the cause of brand new friction. I have no idea what he's been doing with his money. It's not gambling, that much I do know. He stays away from the Indian casinos and usually dreads these conventions when they're in Vegas. He thinks gambling is too much of a gamble, because most people lose. That's not really it. Isaac is just too cheap. "Yes, I made it. As a matter of fact, I paid too." "Thank you, and have a good time," I say, without moving my fingers, which are frozen 2 or 3 inches above the keys. I co-signed for this loan to help him start his business. After it took off, he took over the payments. Unfortunately, I've discovered by default that Isaac isn't as proficient managing his finances as he is at building. To this day, he refuses to hire a bookkeeper, which is one of the reasons his taxes are always late. "Good luck on your research," he says, and heads for the garage. He is so disingenuous. He hardly ever watches my shows anymore. For years, he pretended he was interested, but over time, he couldn't even fake it anymore. He thinks my stories show problems that can't be solved, so what's the point? I finally hear the door shut. I turn around and stare at it. It's red, my bright idea. I'm hoping to hear the garage door go up. There it is. Then the engine roars in his truck. Instead of turning my attention back to the screen, I wait for the handle to turn. Sure enough, in he comes. I forgot my cell phone. He dashes down the hallway to our bedroom. To this day, Isaac reminds me of a Black Paul Bunyan, except he's finally getting a few strands of gray. His mustache and goatee look like they've been sprayed with silver dust. He's still sexy as hell, which is a shame, because it doesn't seem to be serving any purpose. I shouldn't dog him too much. Isaac is a good man. I just think marrying each other wasn't the best thing we could have done for each other. He stops dead in his tracks, pivots, comes over and kisses me in the exact same spot. This time he lets his lips stay a millisecond longer. I appreciate the gesture. I'll call when I get checked in. I make myself some French toast, put a few strips of bacon in the microwave, and sit back in front of my laptop. My mind isn't on teen pregnancy, so I bookmark the sites I may want to look at later. I'm thinking about the man who just left, the one I once loved harder than any of the others. I was a 40-year-old, love-starved Black woman who'd never been married and didn't think it was still possible. I met Isaac in church. He was tall, dark, and handsome. Aren't they always?
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Easy Rollins, Fearless Jones, Leonard McGill, science fiction, young adult, nonfiction, even erotica. Walter Mosley is an amazingly talented, amazingly prolific writer, and I am so thrilled to have him with us today. Readers, I bet like me, you're a fan of his work. His characters are folks you follow from one book to the next. Though I've been an avid Walter Mosley reader, I never knew his personal history. Born in Watts, L.A. in 1952, Mosley's mother was a Polish Jew, and his father, an African-American from Louisiana. Mosley describes his father as a deep thinker and storyteller, a black Socrates. His mother filled his world with European classics from Dickens to Zola to Camus. Mosley attended and then dropped out of a liberal arts college in Vermont, and then earned a political science degree at another. Abandoning a doctorate in political theory, he started working in computers. Later, while working for Mobil Oil, he took a writing course at City College in Harlem. One of his tutors there, Edna O'Brien, became his mentor and encouraged him by saying, "You're black, Jewish, with a poor upbringing. There are riches therein." Mosley started writing at 34 and has written every day since, penning more than 30 books in a variety of categories. Bill Clinton, a fan of murder mysteries, named Mosley as one of his favorite authors. His first published book, Devil in a Blue Dress, was the basis of a 1995 movie starring Denzel Washington, and HBO is currently developing a series based on Mosley's The Long Fall. Last week, regular listeners will recall I featured an excerpt from Mosley's audiobook, Known to Evil. And now, Mosley executes a remarkable change of pace in The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray, a thoughtful, provocative exploration of aging, memory loss, dependence, the quest for autonomy, the role of family and caregivers, and the concern for legacy. Welcome, Walter. I have to ask you straight away, since you are right in the middle of the prime of your life, why did you write Ptolemy Gray now?
Boy, the prime of my life, 58 is the prime of my life.
But I think so.
that's a change. I wrote Ptolemy Gray because of my mother who died 2 years ago from I don't know what she died from exactly, but she was in she had dementia, and that had a serious impact on her and on everybody around her, including me, and learning to communicate with my mother in that state made me want to, explore it in literature, in a literary sense. And so the book is very much about her.
Mm. Why is your main character called Ptolemy?
It's funny. You might say Ptolemy is an African name, though it isn't really. It's a Greek name. The Greek colonizers of Egypt. I think that it just in that attempt to kind of connect with your past, that the naming of Ptolemy is an attempt on his parents' part to connect with his past, and of course Ptolemy at the same time is trying to connect with his past to make it work.
You're known for strong, charismatic male characters, yet in this new book, you spotlight a powerful young female. Is this a new direction for you?
I don't think so. I mean, I always write about strong black women in my books. The thing is that I also always write about black male heroes. I don't think it's a change.
Do you think American families honor their aging parents and grandparents, or do you feel Western society neglects our elders?
I think that there's a tendency in our economic system to neglect those people who aren't seen as productive members of society. And so that when people get old, they're discarded by the system to a great degree, and that their value and their dignity is to a great degree ignored and pushed aside.
In your writing, you move back and forth between mystery and non-mystery, and between several very well-known characters. I know our listeners would like to know, do you work on more than one novel at a time?
No, I usually write on one book at a time, but it's an interesting, you know, it's the structure of the business is like, so let's say you finish writing a mystery and you turn it in, and your publisher is reading it and thinking about it, editing it. So, because I write every day, you know, if a month or two goes by while the publisher's thinking, I start writing a new book. So I'm writing on a new book while the editor is thinking about the old book. When I get the old book back, I stop writing on the new book and go back again. And so in a way, there's a kind of a juggling going on, but at any moment, I'm only working on one book.
And do you work at a fixed time every day?
Yes, when I wake up.
Mm. And how many hours a day do you typically work?
Hours, every day.
Hours. And how will you decide what your next book will be?
I have no idea how I decide. It just happens. I start writing, I start working, I start thinking, and then the book comes from there.
How long does it take you to finish a book, usually?
It depends. A book can take anywhere from 6 weeks to 6 years.
Hmm. And what are you working on now that you've finished and Ptolemy is published?
Well, I have a lot of books coming out. So Ptolemy is out today. In March, I have a new Leonid McGill mystery coming out. A few months after that, I have a political monograph called 12 Steps Toward a Political Revelation coming out. After that, I'm doing a few books that are compilations of science fiction novellas. And I'm working on writing a biography of a famous black chemist, Percy Julian.
Hmm. What did he bring to market? What was his achievement?
Well, he helped synthesize the birth control pill, among many other things.
Oh. And I think our readers would like to know, what are you reading right now, or what do you pick up when you need some relaxation?
Well, you know, I love reading science fiction. I read a lot of it. That's one thing. Recently I've been reading the biography of Simon Wiesenthal, the Nazi hunter, which I find, you know, infinitely.
Well, thank you so much, Walter. The Last Days of Ptolemy Gray. It's quite a read.
Thank you so much.
I want to play you a clip from a book I'm reading right now, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. This is actually from what is now a series by the author Stieg Larsson. The mystery is set in Sweden and weaves an intricate web of murder, love, and very timely financial intrigue. Michael Blomqvist, a financial journalist, is at the wrong end of a libel case. He's forced to take a leave of absence from his magazine, and he begins to examine a 40-year-old case of the disappearance of a young scion of one of the wealthiest families in Sweden. The clip you'll hear now is the beginning of the book. However, this clip does not introduce you to one of my favorite characters in the book, a brilliant oddball investigator, Lisbeth Salander, the girl with the dragon tattoo. I wanted to read to you, with some minor paraphrasing, what I consider a wonderful description of this complex character. So here goes. The star researcher was a pale, anorexic young woman who had hair as short as a fuse and a pierced nose and eyebrows. She had a wasp tattoo about an inch long on her neck, a tattooed loop around the biceps of her left arm, another around her left ankle, and a dragon tattoo on her left shoulder blade. She was a natural redhead, but she dyed her hair raven black. She looked as though she had just emerged from a week-long orgy with a gang of hard rockers. Her extreme slenderness would have made a career in modeling impossible, but with the right makeup, her face could have been on any billboard in the world. Sometimes she wore black lipstick, and in spite of the tattoos and the pierced nose and eyebrows, She was, well, attractive. It was inexplicable. Readers, I don't know about you, but that really conjures up a very clear image for me. And now, the girl with the dragon tattoo.
The trial was irretrievably over. Everything that could be said had been said. But Carl Michael Blomqvist had never doubted that he would lose. The verdict was handed down at 10 on Friday morning, and all that remained was a summing up from the reporters waiting in the corridor outside the district court. Blomqvist saw them through the doorway and slowed his step. But questions were unavoidable, and he, of all people, knew that they had to be asked and answered. He straightened up and tried to smile. The reporters gave him friendly, almost embarrassed greetings. "Give us a sound bite, Kalle Blomqvist." It was a reporter from one of the evening papers. Blomqvist, hearing the nickname, forced himself, as always, not to roll his eyes. Once, when he was 23 and had just started his first summer job as a journalist, Blomqvist had chanced upon a gang which had pulled off 5 bank robberies. Blomqvist was staying at a summer cabin near Katrineholm. Exactly why he made the connection he could not explain. But as he was listening to the news report of the latest robbery, he remembered a group of 4 men in a cabin a few hundred meters down the road. 4 blonde athletic types. There had been no good reason to suspect them, but nevertheless he had gone to a hill overlooking their cabin. A Volvo drove up and the young men got out in a hurry, each carrying a sports bag. One took something from the boot, which he hurriedly covered with his jacket. Even from Blomqvist's relatively distant observation post, he could tell that it was a good old AK-4, the rifle that had been his constant companion for the year of his military service. He called the police, and that was the start of a 3-day siege, with Blomqvist in a front-row seat, collecting a gratifyingly large fee from an evening paper. The fall of the gang launched him as a journalist. The downside of his celebrity was that another newspaper could not resist using the headline, "Kalle Blomqvist Solves the Case," after the boy detective in Astrid Lindgren's book. In spite of his respect for Lindgren, he detested the nickname. It took him several years and far weightier journalistic successes before the nickname began to fade, but he still cringed if it was ever used. Right now, he achieved a placid smile and said to the reporter, "Oh, come on, think of something yourself. You usually do." His tone was not unpleasant. They all knew each other, more or less. "You took a real hit in there," said the one from Dagens Nyheter, clearly a young part-timer. "How does it feel?" Neither Blomqvist nor the elder journalist could help smiling. "How does it feel?" The half-witted sports reporter shoves his microphone in the face of the breathless athlete on the finishing line. "I can only regret that the court did not come to a different conclusion," Blomqvist said, a bit stuffily. 3 months in jail and 150,000 kroner damages, that's pretty severe," said the woman from TV4. "I'll survive." "Are you going to apologise to Wennerström? Shake his hand?" "I think not." "So you still would say that he's a crook?" Dagens Nyheter. The court had just ruled that Blomqvist had libelled Hans-Erik Wennerström. So what would happen if he repeated his claim on the court steps? Blomqvist did not want to find out.
Readers, that's all we have time for today. Thanks again to Erin James for her theme music from her Soul Garden album. Phew, what a busy time of year. Remember, if you're entering the fray at the mall this week for a holiday shopping, there's no more precious gift than a wonderful book. This is Elaine Charles, hoping you and your families have a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday. And I'm hoping you'll be back right here next week. Goodbye.